Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old George Kincaid of New Cuyama, California. He served with the 2nd Marine Division in the Pacific during World War II, and thanks to his friend Bob Quirk for letting me know about George and his story. Remember when he was talking about his initial Marine Corps training in San Diego and how he often saw B-24s taking off with the bomb bay doors open and never knew why? Well, I consulted some of my favorite pilots, and here's what I found out. B-24s leaked fuel, so crews often flew with the bomb bay doors slightly open to dissipate potentially explosive fumes, is what I was told. May also have something to do with the ability to jettison bombs if you had an engine failure on takeoff. But an interesting note about the way the bomb bay doors were configured on B-24s, they did not create drag on the aircraft like they did on most bombers. So hope that helps there a little bit, George. We heard about how you enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1942 after a year at Taft Junior College in Kern County, how your younger brother followed you into the Marines not long after. And you said you were an eyewitness to the bloody battle for Tarawa, or Tarawa as some people say, late 1943, but your unit didn't have to get into the fighting there. And let's pick it up from there.
After Tarawa?
Yeah,
we went to Hawaii. We sat there for months, and then we went to Saipan. Saipan and Tinian.
Had you ever heard of Saipan before?
Nope.
Well, so tell me about what you experienced there, and in an engineer outfit, what your role in this invasion, in this landing was.
Well, we didn't have to do anything. The engineers, a lot of guys did. The demolition man was in there, and the truck drivers. But I turned out to be a Jeep driver. I was an adjutant Jeep driver, and I had a buddy of mine in Texas, L.B. Ross. He was a colonel Jeep driver, Colonel Volt, and I had Captain Ricks. And I had the Jeep to do anything I wanted to. If he wasn't driving the Jeep, I did. And, of course, this is after the fighting was over with, see? And I was there when the first B-29, they just took this place for a bomber base. And so they knew they could fly from Saipan and Tinian all the way to Japan and back. So I remember when the first B-29 landed, I got the Jeep, went down, and saw it. And I crawled through it. In it, went in the tail back and forth in the tunnel, see, B-29, see. And then from our barracks where we lived, or tent city where we lived, you could see the fighter strip, and you could see the P-38s. So we go down and watch P-38s take off and land, you know, stuff like that. I remember one day everybody's out there waiting. A jet bomber went over, and this P-47 was already on the ground. And he was heading for the bomber, and the P-38 was on the ground, and he took off and shot the bomber down before the P-47 could get to it. He just come right up underneath the bottom of it. And then something that always bothered me was, I've been to a dozen different air shows around here, every air museum, and I've never seen a night fighter. P-61 night fighter. I don't know where they're at. They never saw us any, I guess, because I remember when they brought those down. Brought them and landed one. We went down and looked at it. That's just a flying fortress. 50-mile machine guns. Oh, gosh. And radio control.
Yeah.
And nighttime, we'd hear a bomber airplane go over. And you'd sit there and wait. And then out to sea, you'd see a big ball of fire. He'd take off, go out there and shoot him down. You'd see him plane falling down. He'd night fire plane coal black, just black as they could paint it.
That's why they called it the Black Widow, right?
That's why they called it the Black Widow. But I never seen one in an air show. There was there. We looked all over that one. March's Museum and Chino, Benicino. They have fly-ins at Santa Maria. We just went to Casmedia to that museum here last year. But it was just everything real quiet. All of a sudden, you look out there, and there that ball of fire is coming down.
You know, there's something about Saipan that I'm curious if you witnessed firsthand, or maybe you just heard about it. But a lot of the guys I've interviewed who were there talk about, you know, a real unfortunate element of the capture of that island, which was what the Japanese forces were telling the civilians, how they lied to them and said that, you know, what you Americans would do
right.
to them.
Yeah, I saw that. They jump off cliffs, take hold of baby ears in their arms, and just poof, draw they go.
And And you watched that with your own eyes?
Yeah, we watched it. Yeah, a lot of you would watch it. Yes.
It was called Marpy Point, the suicide cliff there. Yeah.
They commit suicide. That's even an army lieutenant or officer. If he does something wrong, he kills himself. If he loses his battle or something, you know, Harry carried a little bitty old sword, you know.
I mean, I know you've been living with this for almost 80 years, but that's so jarring to a lot of our senses that a woman would grab her child and jump off a cliff because whatever's been put into her head was so much worse than that. How hard was that to watch, and how angry did that make you to see that happening?
It hurts. It makes you turn around and walk away. You don't want to watch it anymore. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they just brainwash them. What, you know, but we didn't hurt nobody. You know, they built, on Saipan, after they first hit, we built a stockade for the civilians. Just a bunch of fence, you know, barbed wire. But they were never abused.
Being the adjutant's Jeep driver on Saipan, what was that life like? What were some of the assignments you had, some of the places you had to drive? Was there some inherent danger in that job? What was it like?
I'd have to take him to where he wanted to go. Yeah. One day he said, hey, let's go for a ride. And I took him down to main headquarters. He went in there and got the 18th Marines, or payroll, $60,000, and he threw it at me, and I had it and put it down, you know, and we got paid in $2 bills. Yep, they wanted where the money went, so he paid everybody $2 bills. So where could the money go, see, on Saipan?
Right.
The pilots would have to haul it all, because I remember one day there, the radio man said, George, you want to go for a ride? Yeah, okay, and he knew a guy. Well, they had a painting of a room with a bar, and there was a bar on it. People leaning up the bar drinking beer, and there's four men on one side, four men, and a woman was in the middle of the bar, see, sitting in the middle. And the guy on one side had his hand on the cheek of her butt, and the guy on the other side had it on the cheek of her butt, and they rolled up a canvas. We got to take this to Guam. So we went down, got in a C-47, and went through to Guam. This guy that I went with, he flew it back, flew it over, and went on the way back. He let me fly it back. But it's pretty hard to make an airplane fly level if you never flew one before, you know.
So you'd never flown before, but he was crazy enough to let you fly it.
Yeah, I had a stick, and I was flying it with a control, see. Uh-huh. And but he was over there to be sure it went straight.
That sounds like quite a thrill.
That's quite a experience. It was, yeah. Because when I was on Hawaii, before we went to Saipan, I took that tour on that, went to look through the stub. Well, I also went down to the airbase and went for a ride in an SPD Dauntless dive bomber. If they put a new engine in one, they got to test fly it. If they work on a machine guns, they got to take it out and test fire, see? He took us up to 5,000 feet and just peeled off in a dive. No, he went to 7,000 feet. And then, like you said, we're going to dive bomb that building, and he peeled off and straight down. And I looked at the altimeter on that plane, 20,000 feet, you know, and stuff. And boy, that thing was just like a clock unwinding. And he pulled it out right straight up, and then he went straight up and rolled it. I didn't get sick, but dang near it, you know, because it was rough. Later on, he dropped down and like you're going to machine gun something. You know, and he was on top of the surf, and the palm trees is above the airplane. You can look out and see the palm trees, and you was above the palm trees, and he was right on the surf. Boy,
that's quite an e-ticket ride you got there.
Yeah, it was fun. Which, you know, haven't been in an airplane very. You know, that was the first. I think that was my first airplane ride, because the other one was in Saipan.
Yeah, and Saipan and Tinian are often paired together, because Tinian was taken right after Saipan. Did you have any different experiences on Tinian compared to Saipan?
No, I didn't. No, there wasn't much on Tinian, because we used to go down in the morning. The B-29s would start taking off about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. They'd take one about, I don't remember now if it was one a minute or one every 30 seconds, but the clock, 2 hours later, they're still taking off. They took thousands off there all the time. We'd watch them. One time, the plane took off. He couldn't get off the ground. He went out and lit in the ocean. And then we watched them come back, go down at 8 o'clock at night, and they'd be coming home. And you'd see a ball of fire out there. You know, you'd have an engine on fire. Sometimes they make it to the airport. Sometimes they'd land before they get to the airport. They had trouble with their engines on them. They were temperamental.
Well, that's why some of those places were important, that they could, like Iwo Jima and Guam, they could actually land there if they had trouble.
I think they could, if they couldn't make it to Saipan, I think they could land at Guam.
Well, and you told us something earlier, that, you know, after you joined the Marine Corps, your little brother did too.
Yeah.
Were you getting any updates on how your brother was doing or where he was or any of that?
Nope. All I know is when he was on Guam, he got 2 days liberty, and he flew over to Saipan where I was at, and we visited for 2 days. Then he went back to Guam. Then I came home, and then he came home way later. I got home in January 46, and he never got home until middle of 47.
What was that like, hanging out with your brother that far away from home after everything the two of you had been through?
It was pretty good. It was a good feeling, yeah. When you left home, you didn't know whether you was going to get back or not. So then when you meet him over there, it was quite a deal.
And I'm just curious, what kind of stuff you talk about in a situation like that? Do you talk about some of the combat stories, or is that what you avoid and you focus on other things?
Well, I never did actually have to go to combat. You know, of course, we had to learn things. I didn't have nothing to do with demolition, but they showed you how to use a flamethrower. We had, you know, stuff like that in case it did. And every flamethrower guy had a guy with him with a Browning automatic rifle, you know, BAR, to protect him. So it's just, well, you just sometimes you're lucky you make it home.
Yeah, are there some moments that you look back on and you say, you know, I'm lucky I made it through that, or somebody was looking out for me during that situation?
Oh, yeah, you think back, yeah. Your mind goes back quite often about what went on. The closest thing, I think, was we were kept on Tinian, and it was right by a cornfield, and some guy was in there. He'd been in combat a lot. He went out there, and they didn't have no outhouses. He just went out in the corn patch and squatted. When the first thing we know, blam, 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 a Jap was in there, and he shot him. I don't know if the Jap was dead yet. He took his rifle butt and smashed all his gold teeth out and reached his pocket, pulled out a tobacco bag, and just full of gold teeth. A lot of guys did that, they got the gold. And then the Jap come running by the field, and everybody shot at him, and he was about 100 yards away. Nobody hit him. He got away. That's the closest we come to any of us guys had to shoot. We were engineers, and you just didn't do it, see?
Was there anything else about being an engineer that stands out, other things that you guys were tasked with doing that you remember?
Well, I remember one thing, that the tanks couldn't get in where they wanted to go. And so they took a bulldozer and used bulldozer to make a road for the cat, and a sniper got the cat operator, so they went and took some steel plating and made him a cage. So he put that on the dozer where they couldn't get him, and so he ended up making a road for the tanks to get in there.
Yeah, being an engineer wasn't necessarily a safe job. I mean, a sniper can hit you just as well as anybody else.
Whatever you done, see? Truck drivers, Jeep drivers, you know?
And were you still on Tinian when the Enola Gay took off and dropped the atomic bomb?
Yep, well, I was there, yeah. Of course, we didn't know it. It was all secrecy, see? Because Enola Gay dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima. Then Boxcar dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. And then they quit fighting on my birthday.
Yeah.
August 14th. And I think 2 weeks later, we board ship, and 2 weeks later, we docked in Nagasaki.
And that's where he would witness things that very few people still with us today can say they saw with their own eyes. What did he see at Nagasaki, and how does that color his perspective as he approaches his 100th birthday this next VJ Day? We'll hear it in George's words when we come back. And if you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of George then and now, and you'll even see a pretty unique piece of World War II memorabilia. It's a piece of a Japanese fighter plane, a Zero, but you might be surprised to see what George has fashioned it into. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.